Today is Monday, June 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, as tensions rise between the U.S. and Iran, some Democratic lawmakers blame the Trump administration.
Our allies warned the United States. I think our intelligence agencies warned policymakers that this kind of Iranian reaction was likely a result of a policy of withdrawing from the Iran nuclear agreement.
Nearly 2 million people fill the streets of Hong Kong, even as leaders delay a vote on a controversial proposed extradition law. Also ahead, pop singer Taylor Swift gives a surprise performance at a gay bar in New York City. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is reaching out to wary foreign leaders, framing alleged Iranian attacks in a Middle East oil shipping route as a problem for the world. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
We will continue to take actions that deter Iran from engaging this kind of behavior. I made a number of calls to my colleagues around the world yesterday. I am confident we will have partners that understand this threat.
On Fox News Sunday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo stressed diplomacy.
We don't want war.
But Senator Tom Cotton tells CBS's Face the Nation.
Unprovoked attacks on commercial shipping warrant a retaliatory military strike.
Congressman Adam Schiff, who also appeared on CBS's Face the Nation, says the administration should be consulting allies.
We should be trying to corral a response, though, from the international community to protect shipping, to impose sanctions. But because we have so alienated ourselves from our allies, that's not happening.
Ben Thomas, Washington.
In Hong Kong, demonstrators again took to the streets in massive numbers Sunday to protest a controversial extradition bill. Angela Wu was at last week's violent protests and is condemning how police dealt with the peaceful demonstrators.
Wednesday, what I can see from the TV is absolutely unacceptable. They are using violence, which is for a clearance. They are using tear gas, beanbag shots, and some, tear gas, beanbag shots, pepper spray, and as well as the rubber bullets, so which is really, really unacceptable.
The protests Sunday come as Hong Kong authorities suspended the proposal indefinitely over public concerns that it left people vulnerable to being sent to communist-controlled mainland China. As VOA's Bill Gallo reports, the demands of the protesters appear to be changing.
A show of force by protesters in Hong Kong after authorities suspended but did not kill a controversial extradition bill. Their message, just pausing the bill isn't good enough. Many are concerned the bill means they risk being extradited to China with its politicized judicial system. Following some of the biggest protests in Hong Kong's history, on Saturday, the government here paused the bill.
There was a real question coming into Sunday whether the decision to suspend this extradition bill would help satisfy some of the protesters enough so that they wouldn't come out into the streets in mass numbers. As you can see behind me, that is not the case. Many people here are not happy. They've dressed up in black. They want this bill completely killed. They're also calling for Carrie Lam, the chief executive here, to step down.
Lam, a pro-Beijing leader, is fighting for her political life. Many protesters blame her for the violence that erupted during protests last week.
I think the bill should be taken off and Carrie Lam should step down. We don't trust her.
If the extradition is approved, Hong Kong is equal to China.
This is an end game. This is almost like an overnight change of Hong Kong if this bill is being passed. It would change Hong Kong forever.
Lam on Sunday apologized for her handling of the situation, but gave no signs of further concessions. For many here who are already worried about China's growing influence, the future looks more uncertain than ever. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Hong Kong.
Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says President Trump plans to discuss the Hong Kong issue with his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping at the upcoming G20 summit in Japan. Hong Kong, a former British colony, was granted special autonomy for 50 years after it returned to Chinese sovereignty in 1997. But many in Hong Kong are concerned China is slowly encroaching on those rights and tightening its grip on the territory. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Hundreds of thousands demand Hong Kong leaders' resignation Indonesia vows to send back illegal plastic waste. The Taliban and U.S. are set to hold crucial rounds of talks, or Afghan peace talks. And in New York City, apparently it's a new spot for whale watching. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Cameroon says separatist fighters have killed four policemen and wounded six in the English-speaking southwestern town of Yomojak. The separatist fighters use of bombs is the first to be reported since the conflict that has nearly killed nearly 2,000 people and started 3 years ago. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
200 internally displaced people from Cameroon's English-speaking southwest met Sunday in Yaoundé to examine increasing violence during the past months. They say raids on Tinto, Kembong, and Eyang localities the military considers separatist strongholds have left at least 17 people dead. Teacher Nestor Orok, who escaped fighting in Tinto a year ago, says the latest of the killings was Saturday when explosives blew up a police van at Yomojok. He says some people who had been considering returning home are scared.
This thing started with din guns and now we're talking about bombs. It means that we are not secure. Something should really be done to make sure that we have a lasting peace. People are suffering, and if policemen who are supposed to provide security are being killed with bombs, then we don't know where we'll find ourselves.
Cameroon Communication Minister and government spokesperson René Emmanuel Sadi has confirmed the attack. He says the police were on a peacekeeping mission to Manyu. Sadi says the government needs help from the public.
The government strongly condemns, warns those who persist with dark intentions that they shall be held accountable for the consequences of the exactions committed. The government appealed to the sense of responsibility, patriotism, and civic spirit of the populations, and especially youth, not to yield to manipulations blinded by reckless ambitions.
Cameroon accuses some of its citizens in the diaspora of funding the secessionists and contributing money to buy arms. The separatists have recently used social media to show bombs and guns they say they purchased and smuggled to Cameroon. Cameroonian-born political analyst Nelson Ari of the University of N'Djamena in Chad says Cameroon should no longer neglect the strength and firepower of the separatists, thinking that they are poorly armed.
Actually, this is the first attack by separatist groups using heavy weapons. It shows that there is an inflow of weapons into the country from borders. And if the government of Cameroon doesn't call for dialogue, it's going to be hard. People are dying.
The crisis in the northwest and southwest regions of Cameroon escalated on October 1, 2017, when militant secessionist groups symbolically proclaimed what they called the independence of an English-speaking state. The United Nations estimates more than 530,000 people have been displaced since fighting broke out. It says about 1.3 million people are in need of assistance. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Power is being restored to Argentina and Uruguay after a massive electrical failure left more than 44 million people without electricity Sunday. A massive blackout was caused by an unexplained failure in the country's interconnected power grid. VOA's Slatica Hoke reports the power outage affected families and business as well as underground transportation, which depends on electric power.
Argentinian authorities are investigating an unprecedented power blackout that affected several South American countries on Sunday after generators at a hydroelectric plant in Paraguay suddenly went offline. As a result, there was a power loss across Argentina and Uruguay, as well as parts of Paraguay, Brazil, and Chile.
Everything was pitch black except for the car lights passing around 7 a.m. You just could not see anything. Everything was black.
The blackout disrupted Sunday plans for millions of people in the affected area.
I was just on my way to eat with a friend, but we had to cancel everything because there's no subway. Nothing's working. The blackout brings so many difficulties. Moreover, today is Father's Day. I've just talked to a neighbor, and he told me his sons won't be able to meet him.
The power loss also affected businesses that are open on Sundays, such as restaurants and grocery stores.
As we don't have electricity, the fruit and vegetables, with the humidity, go bad quicker than usual.
The electricity was restored to parts of Argentina and Uruguay later Sunday, but the problem was far from being solved.
The electricity comes and goes. It isn't very stable. We hope it'll work.
Paraguay's officials said the breakdown began with an event in Argentina's power network that disconnected all generators at the Yacyretá hydroelectric dam from the regional grid on Sunday morning. Argentina's president Mauricio Macri said in a tweet that the power loss was caused by a fault in the coastal transmission system. He promised the failure will be thoroughly investigated. The unprecedented outage underscored the vulnerability of a regional grid to glitches in a local system. Zlatica Hoch, VOA News, Washington.
A new report by SIPRI, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, finds conflict and climate change are largely responsible for rising global hunger. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
More than 800 million people around the world are going hungry. SIPRI reports 60% are in conflict-affected countries. It says political instability and conflict-related displacement generate food crises. The Stockholm Research Institute says food is often inaccessible to people caught in conflict. It says limited supplies of these commodities cause prices to spiral, making food largely unaffordable. Climate change, it says, is worsening the ability of people to get enough to eat. It says hunger is growing as crops and livelihoods in impoverished countries are wiped out by extreme flooding and drought. The UN's World Food Program reports Yemen suffered the worst food crisis last year, followed in order of severity by DR Congo, Afghanistan, Ethiopia, Syria, Sudan, South Sudan, and northern Nigeria. WFP spokesman Hervé Verhoosel says these eight countries account for two-thirds of all people facing acute hunger.
Even in conflict-affected areas with limited access, such as South Sudan and Yemen, when we can do our job safely and have consistent access to people in need, we can prevent the worst form of hunger. We only see famine now when our staff are not able to reach the food insecure people due to insecurity or where our access is blocked.
Verhoosel says more than 113 million people in 53 countries suffer from acute hunger and are in urgent need of food, nutrition, and livelihood assistance. He notes conflict and insecurity are the main drivers of hunger in 21 of these countries. WFP is the world's largest humanitarian agency fighting hunger. Each year, it provides food assistance to nearly 90 million people in areas affected by conflict and natural disasters. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And you are listening to International Edition on VOA.
Voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Heidi Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
The VOA's International Edition continues. A new podcast explores the dramatic history of the U.S. state of Oklahoma and Native American land rights and how they are clashing. This Land is a documentary-style program with each segment taking us deeper into the story that's now playing out in real time as tribes await a United States Supreme Court decision that could come at any moment. The court's decision will decide the fate of five Native tribes and sacred lands that they've held in treaties over the past 180 years. It covers over half the land of the state of Oklahoma, a decision expected to be handed down by the end of the month. Joining us to talk more about it is the host of This Land, Cherokee Nation citizen, advocate, and journalist Rebecca Nagel. Rebecca, thank you for being with us. So what started this whole dispute that landed up in the U.S. Supreme Court?
So the case originated in a really unusual place. It actually started with a murder in a small town in eastern Oklahoma in 1999. And what happened after the murder, what happened with the murder is that a Creek citizen killed another Creek citizen and then was sentenced to death by the state of Oklahoma. And in his appeal, he said that Oklahoma didn't have jurisdiction to prosecute him for the crime because it happened on a reservation. And states can't prosecute crimes that happen on reservations if they're committed by Indians. Mr. Murphy appealed his death sentence and said that the murder happened on his tribe's reservation and therefore Oklahoma couldn't prosecute him. Well, he won in a federal appeals court and Oklahoma appealed, and basically Oklahoma's argument is that that reservation no longer exists. And so that's the question in front of the Supreme Court. Does Muscogee Creek Nation still have a reservation? And what happened is Oklahoma says that basically when it became a state, all the laws that Congress passed to pave the way for Oklahoma to exist, that those laws disestablished Muscogee Creek Nation's reservation. Hmm. The problem with that is that basically for Congress to end a reservation, they have to put it in writing. You know, they have to basically say this land is no longer going to belong to the tribe, or this reservation is terminated, or we're selling this off, or something like that. And in this situation, no such law has ever been passed about Muscogee Creek Nation's reservation or about the reservations of four other tribes in Oklahoma, because we all share a very similar history. And so depending on how the decision is ultimately written, it could end up impacting the treaty territory of five tribes in Oklahoma and about half the land in the state.
That's a pretty big deal when it comes to Native American land. They've, throughout history, lost a lot of their land. The Supreme Court, they've already heard the case?
Yeah, so basically where the case is at right now is that the arguments were actually in November, and the only thing that's left is for the Supreme Court to issue their decision, and the latest possible time that they could do that is the end of June. And so it could come out any week now, and pretty much has to come out in the next couple of weeks.
How does the tribe feel as far as the results? Are they feeling optimistic? I'm sure they're concerned and worried.
I think it's probably easier for me to speak from my own perspective. I think it could go either way. I mean, I'm really hopeful that we'll win. The law is clearly on the tribe side. But then the big question mark is whether or not that's what the Supreme Court is going to follow. So if they follow the text, if they follow precedent, if they follow the letter of the law, the tribe wins hands down. But there are some really powerful interests that have a lot of money, you know, like the oil and gas industry in Oklahoma, the state, the Trump administration chimed in on this case. And those entities hold a lot of sway. So if the Supreme Court listens to them, then they could rule against the tribe and ignore what the law says.
What is the Trump administration's view on this?
So the Trump administration actually intervened really early, like before the Supreme Court had even decided whether or not they were going to hear the case. The Trump administration petitioned the Supreme Court to not only hear the case, but to rule in favor of Oklahoma. And they also intervened during oral arguments. And so a lawyer representing the United States argued against the tribes at oral argument. So they haven't been shy about what side they're taking.
What I also find interesting is that while the Supreme Court leaning toward the right now conservative Supreme Court, you all are also concerned about an unlikely suspect, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who is pretty liberal and usually would you would think would be in the corner of the Native Americans.
Yeah, I think the thing that is interesting about Native rights is that it doesn't always follow party lines. Ruth Bader Ginsburg is a really good example. You know, she's almost Brooks become the symbol of the left on the Supreme Court and is kind of hero right now. But when it comes to the rights of tribes and treaty rights, her record on the Supreme Court is not great. And actually, in this case, one justice is sitting out, Gorsuch, because he dealt with the case when it was in a lower court. And so it's actually only 8 justices that are going to vote, which means if it's a tie, which is a 4-4 decision, the tribe wins. A tie upholds the lower court's decision, which is basically a long way of saying that the tribe only needs 4 votes to win. And if there are 4 liberal justices, you would think, okay, you know, like, we've got it. It's a shoo-in. Sadly, Ruth Bader Ginsburg is where it becomes not a sure deal. She authored a decision in a case that's not exactly identical, but had some similar questions about whether or not a tribe's treaty territory was still theirs in 2005. And she ruled against the tribe for reasons that had a lot to do with not wanting to rock the boat, not wanting to disrupt the established norms and expectations of non-Native residents in this area, and instead of following treaty rights and the letter of the law. So it is concerning what her record is on Native rights and treaty issues.
What can we expect from future episodes?
So the first 2 episodes are out. The next episode, we're really going to dive into the oppositions, you know, the Trump administration, oil and gas in Oklahoma, and what are they saying in this case, and break down and bust up some of the myths that they're using about tribes and Indians and show people why those things aren't true. And I'm also really excited. I think people will be really interested in the second half of the season. The reason I'm telling the story is because my family are actually treaty signers. So the land that's at stake in this case that belongs to Cherokee Nation is land that my ancestors signed the treaty that guaranteed that land to my tribe. But now Oklahoma is saying no longer belongs to us. And so I'm going to get into that personal story of my family history of how my tribe came to Oklahoma, and then also tell the story of what happened where Oklahoma now says that that land doesn't belong to my tribe. And then we'll get into some of the present day stakes about why this land matters, why a reservation matters, and also what are the different issues that tribes are facing right now in the federal courts in defending our rights.
All right, that's Cherokee Nation citizen advocate and journalist Rebecca Nagel. You can find this podcast anywhere you listen to podcasts or at thislandpodcast.com.
This is Science in a Minute.
A study recently published in the journal Atmospheric Chemistry and Physics suggests the thawing permafrost in Alaska is releasing emissions of nitrous oxide at a rate that's about 12 times higher than had been assumed. Nitrous oxide is considered the third most significant human-generated greenhouse gas behind carbon dioxide and methane. Climate scientists say greenhouse gases traps heat in the atmosphere and warms the planet. Lead author of the study, Jordan Wilkerson from Harvard University, said small increases in nitrous oxide emissions would have the same effect on climate change as a large plume of carbon dioxide. The study points out that once in the stratosphere, nitrous oxide combined with sunlight and oxygen also changes into nitrogen oxides, which may harm the ozone. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Taylor Swift made a surprise performance at an iconic gay bar a day after releasing a song supporting the LGBTQ community. Swift celebrated Pride Month by appearing at New York City's Stonewall Inn on Friday night. She released her new tune Thursday called You Need to Calm Down, where she calls out those who attack the LGBTQ community. The song is the second single from Swift's 7th album, Lover, which will be released August 23rd. Swift sang her hit song Shake It Off at the New York City Bar with Modern Family actor Jesse Tyler Ferguson, who hosted the event. Ferguson is working on a documentary about Stonewall Inn, where patrons resisted a police raid in 1969 and helped spark the gay rights movement. The bar is marking 50 years since the riots. And you have been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
After more than 8 years of brutal conflict in Syria, the humanitarian needs of the Syrian people are dire and ongoing, said Carol O'Connell, U.S. Acting Assistant Secretary of State for Population, Refugees, and Migration, in a recent interview.
When we look at Syria, it's really a catastrophic crisis. 8 years into the crisis, we still have displaced persons inside Syria who every day are still looking for their basic needs for their families, for food, for shelter, for water, for health care. They're trying to find safety and protection.
Acting Assistant Secretary O'Connell said the United States is committed to continuing its support for those 6.2 million internally displaced people, as well as for the 5.6 million refugees that had to flee the country, in many cases leaving everything behind. To date, the United States is the largest single donor for the Syria response, providing more than $9.5 billion in humanitarian assistance for those affected by the conflict inside Syria and throughout the region since the start of the conflict. In conjunction with key international and non-governmental partners, the United States funding supports emergency food and nutrition assistance, shelter, safe drinking water, medical care, improved sanitation, and humanitarian protection activities. The United States has provided humanitarian assistance to international organizations that are providing these crucial services throughout Syria, including in camps for displaced persons in the northeast. U.S. funding also helps support communities in Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey, Iraq, and Egypt that are generously hosting Syrian refugees. The Syrian conflict, which began in 2011 when Syrian President Bashar al-Assad violently attacked peaceful, pro-democratic protesters, has resulted in what has been called the worst humanitarian crisis in our lifetime. The United States will continue to lead the international community in efforts to alleviate the suffering of the Syrian people inside their country and throughout the region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. for a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
This is VOA News.